The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Endocarditis and prophylaxis, infectious GI diseases, is presented by Dr. Gerald Blackburn.
If this case is presented to you with this chest x-ray and the sputum grows out staph aureus, what's the diagnosis? Right-sided endocarditis. It's not staph pneumonia. Those are all the embolic phenomena from staph. So there's lots of material here, and I'm not going to read it all to you, but the suspicion of endocarditis starts with so-called persistently positive blood cultures. And the formal criteria is taken 12 hours apart with an organism that is at risk for causing endocarditis, such as staph aureus. But the key thing is multiple blood cultures spaced in time. And they like to ask questions about the so-called HACIC group. The H part of this is changing, but it'll take years before the board questions catch up with that. So for now, we'll stay with this. HACIC includes Haemophilus, but not influenza, and all these other organisms that are listed here. Anytime you have a bacteremia from these, that's endocarditis until proven otherwise. In your handout, in the whatever are the Duke criteria, but I'm not going to read them all to you. You can look at them anytime you want. The major clinical criteria for definite, possible, and probable. Soft signs, peripheral stigmata, include rust spots in the gold or yellow, because that's been on the boards. And all these other findings that would support that diagnosis of endocarditis. Here are some pictures of real patients. The top left are Roth spots, the conjunctival hemorrhages. The patient on the bottom left was one of ours. This is not what you want to find on someone you care about. And she actually was refusing heart surgery because she was undocumented and was afraid that if she became that part of the medical care system, she would be forced out of the country. Rust spots are not unique or only seen in endocarditis. They're also seen in leukemia. So that could be a tricky question. I'm not aware that they have posed it that way. Other findings are these splinter hemorrhages in the nails and Janeway and Osler. Janeway lesions, Osler nodes. Some people think they're really the same thing or there's a lot of overlap. Pearls about endocarditis. I showed you that x-ray. That's not staph pneumonia. That's right-sided endocarditis, almost always in drug abusers. Strep bovis, bacteremia, I talked about this morning. They keep adding new names or subspecies. So this last one, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Pasteur, and you can pronounce it any way you want. That is showing up on our culture results lately. Bacteremia, endocarditis, highly associated with any part of the GI tract. A positive blood culture with a HACIC organism I mentioned. And the sort of the pimp question is, okay, what's the most common cause of acute endocarditis these days? Staph aureus. Why? Because of prior medical care and basically line infections and other invasive procedures. Indications for surgery. Longstanding has been congestive heart failure, from native valve dysfunction. You do not wait until you treat them, until you finish treating them. If they are in heart failure with endocarditis, they go to surgery now. Mobile vegetation is the one that looks like a little yo-yo on echo, greater than 10 millimeters, and it's generic failure of medical therapy. PIMP questions, most common cause of culture-negative endocarditis, prior antibiotics. What patient ever comes in that hasn't failed therapy from the primary care physician, the ER, or whatever, that gave them a course of Cipro or Levaquin? Slow-growing organisms, the HACIC group, again, nutritionally variant strep, and some of these other uncommon, but they're out there. Brucellosis, Q fever, aspergillus, blood cultures are rarely positive. Prophylaxis, what are the indications? Prosthetic valve or underlying conditions or prior endocarditis, not mitral valve prolapse, which is old school, and we do not prophylax for that. No one even talks about that anymore. Procedures, anything that hurts when they're and bleeds when they're doing dental work on you, or any invasive procedures of the respiratory tract. No longer do we prophylax for GI procedures, such as endoscopy. And then the key thing here for prophylaxis, because you can read the antibiotics and you can read the doses, key thing is one dose, 1 hour prior to procedure, period. That's it. Infections of the GI tract. How many had a salad for lunch? Who wants to admit it? Okay, so foodborne illness. At least 48 to 50 million cases of foodborne illness a year, and that's in this country. So when you think when you hear a patient say, I had a touch of the flu, usually they're talking about diarrhea, vomiting, or some combination. And if it's short-lived, you have to think about food poisoning. And most of the time, we have no clue what caused that. Most of the time, they look back at the last meal that they ate, and it may have nothing to do with that last meal. It may have been the breakfast the day before. So the history is interesting, but where you ate last night is not enough, if you can even piece it together. Leafy green vegetables, 0157H7, E. coli. If you love Caesar salad, you know that there's been outbreak after outbreak related to romaine lettuce. And the prevention of all of this is you cannot wash your vegetables clean enough, especially the leafy vegetables. That's not to say you shouldn't do it, but you cannot wash all those bacteria off there. So chickens, you like to think, or I'd like to think, that these chickens have a nice happy life until they show up in the supermarket. And they're out in the farm eating regular food, having a good time. That's not life as a chicken. This is the chicken you eat from the supermarket. And the problem with these chickens and other types of agricultural practices these days is not only are they crowded together, but look at the number of kilograms of antibiotics that are given to these animals to make them mature, bigger, faster, maybe not get as sick. And this is where antibiotic resistance comes from in large part. Hepatitis A has been on the boards, traditionally fecal oral transmission. Restaurants, food supply, what have you. There's the incubation period here of up to 30 days. How do you diagnose it? Usually IgM antibody. They are quite contagious during the incubation period until after the jaundice shows up. What we are seeing throughout the country now is these major outbreaks of hepatitis A with a whole different epidemiology, mainly in the homeless, mainly in the MSM population, and people who use drugs, although not necessarily needles. But it's that population, and it's probably related to contaminated objects, fomites, and maybe just plain poor hygiene. If you're homeless, where do you take a shower? Where do you wash up when you're homeless? This is the curve that you all saw in medical school. Sort of take a look at that before the boards, because they have asked questions about that. And then hepatitis E. It's always fun to ask the GI folks, what's the most common cause of viral hepatitis? And most of them do not know this answer. Throughout the world, it's hepatitis E. And actually, there's a fairly high seroprevalence of anti-hepatitis E antibody in the U.S. population. But if there's a question on the boards about this, it's going to be about the bottom part. And that is, if you are pregnant and contract hepatitis E, usually in a foreign country, it carries a very high risk of mortality. So if they even ask you about that, it's pregnancy. C. diff. You've all heard C. diff till you're blue in the face. So there's lots of little facts. There's that the NAP1 strain, the O27 strain, is presumably generates a much higher amount of toxin, and that's why you don't, if you had your choice, that's not the strain of C. diff you would like to acquire. It originally was, was described in Canada. And of course, the reaction when these things are seen elsewhere is, that's Canada. But it was, I believe, Toronto or Quebec. And so in Michigan, they didn't worry about it until they actually looked. And when they looked, it's all over the place. And that's true for hepatitis A, it's true for C. diff, it's true for measles, and on. If you look, you're going to find it. We don't do sigmoidoscopies much anymore for C. diff. On the left is what you might describe as from a perfect, you can fill in the blank, with a normal colon. So some people think that this may be from a politician. I don't know. I'm not allowed to comment on that. But on the right is really bad C. diff, pseudomembranous colitis. This is what you would see. And the bottom right is from a colectomy, which still is carried out in the most severe cases. So what are the risk factors? Everyone knows antibiotics. But to remind you, chemotherapy, PPIs, and NSAIDs are associated with C. diff. And there's a sugar described that is in much of our food supply that has been found to support the growth of C. diff. Chewing gum, ketchup, on. So there's probably, that's not helping the situation. How do you diagnose? Well, good luck to the person trying to write the question, or good luck to you trying to figure out the answer, because we're still looking for the perfect test for this diagnosis. If it is PCR alone, the false positive rate is as high as 50%. So they do the GDH and the toxin and the PCR. If you're toxin positive, that's pretty good. The rest of the studies, you're still scratching your head and saying, is this still C. diff? Flagyl is no longer considered a primary drug for the treatment of C. diff. Oral vancomycin is your first drug. Lots of folks like to go to Difisid, but it's expensive. The response rate between that and Vanco are about the same, but the maybe a lower incidence of recurrence with deficit. Lots of risk factors for relapse, lots of ways to approach it. But I think if I were to ask the question, the key question, the things you should be telling your patients is the chance, I know you're doing fine, but the chance of this coming back is somewhere between 20 and 30 to 35%, even though you responded very nicely. If it comes back again, there's a 60% chance of relapse. And one thing the patients scream about is, you never told me that. So that I always make sure I tell them that. Norovirus, very common. Most of you either have experienced it or know someone that has. It comes through the population primarily in the winter, early spring, hence winter vomiting disease. Often in the, whatever the outbreak, especially Disney cruise ships and other cruise ships, extremely high attack rate, extremely high, up to 90% transmission within a family. Or if you happen to be on a cruise ship, they always make you wash your, or decontaminate your hands with the alcohol thing going, through the line before you eat. If you've done that, but I just sort of cringe when I watch all the people handing all those utensils. I do it anyway, but very high attack rate. And so you can see why. Look at the viral particles that are shed in the stool versus the infectious dose. When you are vomiting, you are basically creating an airborne or an aerosol of norovirus. So if I think it's norovirus and it's your loved one puking and having diarrhea, they're on their own. So you hand them the bottle of water around the door. So the key to norovirus is it's coming out both ends, vomiting, diarrhea, as opposed to, and I'll talk about this in a minute, Shigella, which is also highly communicable, but is diarrhea without vomiting. And they typically, the setting is a cruise ship. So again, nausea, vomiting, fever is uncommon, and with norovirus, you want to die. And then two to three days later, you're right back to normal. So it wipes you out, and then you're promptly better. And it's an amazing virus. We had one of our problem physicians that we shut down the rehab unit at our place because all the patients were getting norovirus. And this rehab doc went nuts. Yeah, you can't do that. Then he got it. He was still calling, but it was the whine about how bad he felt. Okay, Staph aureus, food poisoning, traditional church picnic, heat, sunlight, whatever. And then 4 to 6 hours later, you are vomiting. Diarrhea is uncommon. Fever is uncommon. You're just throwing up and throwing up and throwing up. 4 to 6 hour incubation period. And that's where you do look back to the last meal. Bacillus cereus, in gold here. Fried rice, same incubation period. Traveler's diarrhea, usually enterotoxigenic E. coli, but it sort of depends where you go. And it's believed due to the fact that the food is often contaminated. Long incubation period, diarrhea, prophylaxis with Pepto-Bismol or Rifaximin, and we don't offer any other antibiotics as prophylaxis anymore, unless we're leaned on, and in which case quinolones are used to treat it. If you're in Mexico, but not in Asia, because there's all the E. coli are quinolone resistant. So we use macrolides. Cholera, contaminated water. The big deal a few years ago was in Haiti, when after the huge storms and earthquakes in Haiti, the water supply or the whole system, healthcare system, fell apart, and it was actually the folks, the UN relief workers from, I believe it was Bangladesh, that showed up to help, but they also brought cholera with them to a system that could not deal with it because the water supply was interrupted. More recently, there's a huge, huge catastrophe in Yemen. No matter what your politics are, to watch the thousands and thousands of people dying from cholera is, to me, unconscionable. Massive amounts of diarrhea, painless, odorless, described as rice water. Mainly, in many parts of the country, is just hydration and replace the salts. And if you have the option, doxy, azithro, or quinolones, or there's actually, they're talking now about phage therapy for cholera, which is sort of cool. Listeria. Question about Listeria will probably not be about this as a GI organism, but it might be as the source of Listeria, which are unpasteurized or contaminated dairy products, such as ice cream, or the folks that drink raw or unpasteurized milk. There are these certified farms where you can, they're certified to supposedly to provide safe but unpasteurized milk to people that feel that pasteurization destroys the benefit of milk. There's also collectives where you get a group of 8 or 10 families that believe that this unpasteurized milk is good for you, so they buy their own cow, and then they share the milk from that cow that's not pasteurized. There's been so many outbreaks of stuff associated with that, it's mind-blowing. But Listeria is one of them. The other are hot dogs. All the deli meats can be contaminated with Listeria, which is why if you're pregnant, you're advised don't eat raw hot dogs, don't eat deli meats, don't eat, you name it, depends on what foodborne outbreak you want to bring up. But mainly, these are the deli meats that also happen to grow, the Listeria happens to grow at low for a long time when it's cold, at low temperatures. So that hot dog that's been sitting in the back of the refrigerator for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, don't serve that to anyone you really like. And traditionally, hot dogs are cooked before you buy them. So there are people, kids in particular, eat the hot dogs right out of the refrigerator. Probably not a good idea. Give those old, old hot dogs to your in-laws, but not to your kids. So from a GI standpoint, you don't treat it. Although some people will give antibiotics if it's an immune compromised patient, for instance, and they know they've been exposed. But generally, you don't treat the GI illness, you treat the meningitis. And the meningitis is seen commonly in folks who are immunosuppressed with cellular immunity compromised, Hodgkin's disease type of illnesses. So what about E. coli 0157H7? First described in or from McDonald's many years ago. And the McDonald's event or outbreak occurred when people ate their hamburger or ordered their hamburger right at noon, right at rush hour. So when they went back, Those people had flunked McDonald University or Hamburger University and were taking the hamburgers off the grill too soon because it was rush hour. So this is where all the thing about cooking your meat to 165 degrees and on and on and on is all about the undercooked hamburgers from McDonald's and then Jack in the Box. And there's still outbreaks of this. Still outbreaks now of romaine lettuce, as I mentioned. There's been outbreaks related to going to petting farms and having your kids pet all these animals. And then, of course, they don't know anything about hygiene. So their hand goes from the cow to their mouth, or unfortunately, from the cow to your mouth. So not a good idea. And most recent, which shocked a lot of people, or at least surprised people, is they found this organism in flour. You don't think of flour as being contaminated with anything. And how can you eat chocolate chip cookie dough when you know this is going on? Bloody diarrhea. It's described as the worst pain. When this was described from McDonald's, it was the worst pain that folks had seen and ever experienced. They said it was worse than childbirth, worse than passing a kidney stone. So very, very severe abdominal pain and usually no fever. But the incubation period is interesting. It's usually 3 or 4 days. So last night's meal means nothing. And who can remember what you ate 3 or 4 days ago? No antibiotics should be given if you suspect this infection, particularly quinolones. The feeling is that as it kills off the bacteria, it may release more of the toxin, more of the sugar toxin. So no antibiotics, that's the question I would build into this. Shigella, a little bit like norovirus, highly contagious, high attack rate, but there's no vomiting. It's bloody diarrhea. If a patient has a positive blood culture for Shigella, think about HIV. You don't have to be HIV positive to have a positive blood culture, but the odds are very high, particularly a young male, which is what we've seen, that happens to pop up with a positive blood culture. What the heck's going on? They're HIV positive. Current recommendations are not to treat the routine case. Typhoid fever, it's still out there, not common in this country, but the presentation, especially if I was writing the board question, would not be a diarrheal illness, but it would be a travel history, and you return, and you have a high fever, splenomegaly, with a bradycardia and leukopenia. And that's almost a diagnosis you can make over the phone if you could put all that together. Some folks say that if they did fecal leukocytes, they would be mononuclear. That picture on the right is Rose Spots, one of the GI guys from my institution who has written the boards in the past. Excuse me. Would always ask, can you isolate salmonella from this rash? And the answer is yes, and these are called rose spots. Typhoid fever can be devastating, still kills, and then all the other salmonella that you folks see out there in your practice. Foodborne outbreaks throughout the world, commonly in this country from contaminated eggs, poultry, those little baby chicks that people buy at Easter because they think they're cute, salmonella, turtles, reptiles, iguanas, peanut butter, and on and on and on. You only treat these folks if they're bacteremic or if you're really worried about what would happen to them if they were to become bacteremic. If I were to write a question, it would be further down this list, multiple positive blood cultures. With salmonella in an older person is an endovascular infection, until proven otherwise. Doesn't have to be heart valve, but somewhere in that vascular tree, a calcified aorta, an aortic aneurysm, somewhere in that vascular tree, if they are either persistent or relapsing with salmonella, that's what you're dealing with. This apparently is a legal stimulant that you can buy out there. Kratom, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Well, and there was a very big outbreak from salmonella as part of these capsules. So as you take your pill and get your buzz, you also get your salmonella. Vibrio, not terribly common, but when it occurs, it is a killer. Raw oysters. The little warning down on the left is the kind of thing you'll find posted in restaurants, bars, what have you, along the coast, that where raw oysters is a specialty and highly craved and all that. If you have a liver problem, do not eat raw oysters. This organism will kill you. Septic shock, bullous skin lesions, typical of this. And as I mentioned, liver disease, hemochromatosis, not terribly common, but 60% mortality. Campylobacter, along with Listeria, is the other organism that likes to grow. I'm wrong. Disregard that statement. Just let's go back to Campylobacter. Poultry. Pseudoappendicitis, and there's a link there with Guillain-Barré. Yersinia, that's the other organism along with Listeria that likes to grow in the cold. And it's commonly found in pork or chitlins, which is commonly consumed in the south. So, which is really hog intestine. So, depends where you were raised, depends how you were born, but it's a food of poor people. So, but there have been outbreaks of salmonella. There's been outbreaks of Yersinia and other organisms, but particularly Yersinia, from pork and, as I mentioned, hog and intestine. And these meats support the growth while in the refrigerator. So these are not meats you want to keep lying around. These are not meats you wouldn't want to sort of grab out of the refrigerator as a leftover. You'd at least want to cook it really, really well. Giardia, not everyone knows the old question about camping in the Rockies, drinking from the mountain stream, but it's also common in Russia. It's also commonly contracted from your kid or your grandkid who got it at the daycare center. So it's fairly highly transmitted in the daycare center setting. Cryptosporidium. I'm a couple minutes behind time here, but look at the size of the cryptosporidium in yellow. I think it's a ridiculous question, but they ask it. As opposed to Cyclospora. So they actually ask you the size, or maybe to identify the organism based on the size of the identical looking acid fast positive organisms. These stains are acid fast at the bottom. They look identical. It's the size that they ask about. I don't know who came up with that one. So there's some more information here on amebiasis, ciguatera poisoning, but I'm sort of out of time. Botulism, still out there. Black tar heroin, or just eating. The most recent outbreak of botulism was canned potato salad. Trichinosis, periorbital edema. What would be the question in this country that you would ask a patient if you thought they had trichinosis? It would not be about pork. It would be about wild game. It's almost unheard of in the current pork industry. But for those people that go out and like to kill things and then eat it, watch out for that with trichinosis. And then there's some tables here to sort of help you wade through much of the things I touched upon. But I'm out of town. What's Blackburn's rule number two? If you were here before. There's never been an outbreak of food poisoning from beer and French fries.